Welcome to another in the series of programs on public radio brought to you by the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations. We're broadcasting today from beautiful Point Lookout in scenic Northport, Maine. My name is Ron Jarvella, filling in today for our president, Mac DeFord. Our speaker, Nicholas Thompson, is a senior editor of the New Yorker magazine, who also edits for Bloomberg Television. He has been a guest on Fox News, MSNBC, CNBC, and National Public Radio. Nicholas is a fellow at the New America Foundation and a panelist on CNN's Connect the World with Becky Anderson. His book, The Hawk and the Dove, Paul Nitze, George Kennan, and the History of the Cold War, has been critically acclaimed and will be available at a table here for those of you at the end of the talk who would like to pick up a copy, and he will graciously sign that for you. Today, Mr. Thompson will address us on America's Grand Strategy for Asia. Please give him a warm welcome.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Ron. Thank you to the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations. Thank you to Pat and Anna B., my very generous hosts. I already feel at home here. I just saw my seventh grade English teacher, Miss Baker, whose first name I realized I don't even know, for the first time in 23 years. So if I make any grammatical mistakes or errors in diction, please blame her. thank you for being here. I am the author of The Hawk and the Dove, Paul Nitze, George Kennan, and the History of the Cold War. It is Paul Nitze. I had an incident at a previous talk where somebody at about this moment in the talk stood up and stormed out and said, "I thought we were going to hear from Nietzsche's grandson." So it's Paul Nitze. He's my grandfather. The idea of the book, and what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk about the book. I'm going to tell you some stories from the book. I'm going to tell you how it came to be about. I'll read little sections of the book, which will then lead into a discussion at the end on how Kennan's ideas in foreign policy in particular can be applied to our foreign policy conflicts today. So the idea of the book came about, I guess the seed for the book was planted. I was having dinner at my grandfather's house. Nitze is the, he was probably about 90 years old, and he'd spent his whole life arguing that we need more nuclear weapons, right? He was, in the book, I compare him to a track coach who, when his runner is behind, says, "You need to go faster." And when his runner is ahead, "You need to pull ahead." And when they're even, "You need to go faster." And he's constantly arguing for more nuclear weapons, whether he believes we're trailing the Soviets, whether he believes we're even, whether we're ahead. Whole life, that's his philosophy. He has different justifications at different times, very complex, very complicated understanding of why and exactly when. But it's always the same, faster, more faster. At the end of his life, in 1999, he writes an op-ed in the New York Times. And the op-ed says, "You know what? Cold War's over. We don't need these things. Let's chuck them in the sea." And it's quite a turn. And I was at his house maybe 2 weeks later. I was a young journalist in Washington. I was working for the Washington Monthly. And I go over. I would have dinner with him fairly frequently. He was this wonderful man. He sort of slowed down by that point, 92 years old, with a white, scratchy beard. And he would come over, invite people over. We'd play bridge and talk. And after dinner, there were probably eight of us over there. He said he wanted to read a letter. And he sits down on the couch, and he opens a letter. And the letter says something, I can't remember exactly, but it's quoted in the book. But it says, "Dear Paul, I read your op-ed in the New York Times today. Isn't it nice that after 50 years, we finally find ourselves in accord on matters that meant so much to us in times gone by? Your friend, George Kennan." I thought, wow, what an amazing letter. And then afterwards, I said to my grandfather, I said, "Gramps, that's a very meaningful letter. It seems as there's a lot behind that. Tell me something about that." And my grandfather says, "George, he could always write." And so that's when I thought there might be something more to this relationship. Then in 2004, my grandfather died. 6 months later, Kennan died. And that was when I was reading Kennan's obituary, and I realized how much their lives intersected. That I realized that there actually could be a book. And then talking to my father and realizing that Kennan had come to my parents' wedding. I mean, there was a real relationship between the two men. So they were friends but rivals for 50 years. They agreed and they had entirely different views of American foreign policy, diametrically opposed, but they'd worked together for a period And so I thought, okay, you can really tell the story of America during the Cold War, or you can try to tell the story of America during the Cold War by looking at their lives. And you can make Cold War history about these two people, about these two men, about what they do from 1945 to 1990. And you can look at all the stories. You can look at the exciting moments. You can try to find the points where they argue, try to find the points where they agree. So that's what the ambition of the book is, and whether it succeeds or fails, it's, you know, up to you. So the book begins in 1945. Kennan is the... He's the ranking American in the embassy in Moscow. And so the book begins with a scene of him on the balcony. And he's looking out over Red Square. Moscow, the Russians have been our ally during World War II to defeat the Germans. Kennan, though, however, has served in the embassy for quite some time, and he's been there during the purge trials, and he has a sense of who Stalin is and that this guy's not really nice. So the book begins with Kennan looking out over the masses, and Kennan is this sort of this nervous, shy, he's a very despairing man. I'll read you some diary entries in a minute or two, where you'll see just how much he broods and how dark a thinker he is. And it's this moment of great triumph and this moment of elation and celebration, and people are hoisting American soldiers on their arms. And so it begins with Kennan looking out over the crowd, thinking, I have to say something. I'm the ranking American here. I really do need to say something, but these people are fools. This alliance is not going to last 15 more minutes. You know, this is doomed. And so it begins this moment of tension where Kennan is worrying about the future, trying to step into the moment, and that's Kennan at the very beginning of the Cold War. My grandfather, he comes from Wall Street. He's much less seasoned in all this stuff. He comes into the government in 1940, actually. So by 1945, when the book begins, he's working in Germany, and his job is German roots, spoke German. His job is to go and find all the ex-Nazi leaders and interview them. So he has this fascinating job. And the first major thing he does, this is May of 45, so just a few weeks after Kennan in Red Square, is to interview Albert Speer. And he spends, you know, days talking to Speer about the interviews actually become the basis for, you know, parts of the Hugh Trevor Roper's history at the end of the Third Reich. And these crazy stories about Hitler's bunker and Speer and what they did. But what actually matters about it is my grandfather comes to appreciate that Speer, while on the side of evil, had the mind of a master tactician. And he understood exactly how bombing raids worked. He could remember every single one of them. He talked about how he would try to confuse the Americans. He would put certain factories that he didn't mind if they were blown up. You put them in an obvious place. And, you know, but we really need ball bearings. You know, we can't lose those. So bury those underground. And my grandfather just had this amazing set of interviews where he really learns that if you get into the strategy of warfare, and if you get into what weapons you have, what weapons you don't have, you can succeed in a conflict. And so it has a real influence on my grandfather. All right, so the book begins then. The two men, you know, traces their lives back and forth. Kennan's big break comes in February of 1946. Less than a year later, he's been writing ever since May. He's been writing these letters about Stalin and the Soviets, and they're not to be trusted. They're not our allies. And Stalin gives a speech at the Bolshoi Theater, and it's a very dark, negative speech about five-year plans and the coming war with America. State Department, you know, sends Kennan a memo. Why did he say that? Kennan, you know, it's just, I've been writing memos for, you know, a year telling you that this is going to happen. What do you mean? Why do you say that? And so Kennan says, all right, I'm not going to respond with three paragraphs. I'm going to let them have it. And he's sick, and so he lies down on his couch, and he dictates this amazing 6,000-word telegram about the, you know, history of Russian Empire, why they shall never be trusted. It's the famous long telegram. He goes down to dictate it. I'm going to pause for a second. One of my favorite moments when I was reporting this, working and researching this book, was what comes next. The whole idea here is to get inside these scenes, to find people who were there, to find diary entries, things that can give some texture and color in life, as I learned in seventh grade writing. And I desperately wanted to find someone who'd been in the embassy with George Kennan in 1946. And I finally tracked down someone who'd worked there. She'd, you know, been low level, 23-year-old secretary. I go to her house and sit down. My name is Martha Mottner. She sadly just passed away. And I sit down in her living room and I say, Miss Mottner, do you remember anything about the long telegram? She says, why, yes, I tried to stop it. It turned out that this person I met had been working in the code room when Kennan came down with his 6,000-word document. She had a date that night with a young Swede she was very attracted to. She did not want to have to spend several hours retyping it and sending it. So she says to Kennan, no need to send this. You've said it all before. for better or worse, Kennan prevails. He sends it, and we get the Cold War. So Kennan sends the memo, this document. The document says, look, this is the history of the Soviet Union. This is the history of Stalin. These people will never be our friends. This is what they're trying to do. This is how we stop them. It begins to lay out the doctrine called containment, which we'll talk about a little bit later. The idea being that the Soviet Union has these inherent expansionist policies. They will continually view us as their enemy because they need to have an enemy to justify their internal repression and their internal failures. What we need to do is to stop working with them, to stop pretending that they're going to be our ally and our friend, not go to war with them, not threaten them, but just push back, you know, contain them, prevent them from expanding and wait, and eventually they will collapse. And that's the idea in the Long Telegram. He later expands it in his famous X article a year later, but that's the document he sends. Mottner doesn't stop it. It goes through. It goes to Washington. You know, as these things happen, you know, everybody in Washington reads it. It gets passed around. It goes viral, as we would say today. And suddenly Kennan is thought of not just as this slightly irritating man who sends these cranky memos from the Moscow embassy, but he's the great sage. So he's summoned back, comes back to Washington. He starts giving speeches. He's much beloved. He's brought into the inner circle. Soon he's brought in to run the policy planning staff. And this is the organization that will advise the State Department on grand matters of foreign policy, so grand strategy. So he does this. My grandfather, he stays in Germany, comes back, he goes to Japan. He's actually in Hiroshima right after the atomic bomb is dropped. One of his, the first major paper of his life is the effects of the atomic weapons on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. What effect did they have on the war? You know, did they help end the war? He, you know, writes a major document in that endless debate, which no one has settled. Comes back to Washington. He works, he's sort of lower down in the State Department. He's a great numbers man from Wall Street. Rises up. Kennan had actually met him on a train. My grandfather, Kennan is a sort of deep, brooding, antisocial guy who, you know, if he were here, would sort of be off and over there, you know, writing poetry, sketching in black and white. And my grandfather would be shaking everybody's hand. And so my grandfather had come up and met him on a train once in 1943. And so Kennan, in 1947, knew about this friendly guy, Nitze, good reputation with numbers. Kennan didn't like math. Kennan said, well, maybe we should hire him. Dean Acheson said, no, you don't want him. He's just a Wall Street guy who doesn't know how to think. He's rejected. 2 years later, though, Kennan prevails, and my grandfather is hired. So in the my grandfather comes on board the policy planning staff about May, June 1949. And the two men, for a very brief period of time, work together. And there's, you know, this is sort of post-Marshall Plan, but they've both worked on the Marshall Plan. They both worked on the big question of how to deal with the Berlin crisis. Many of the great issues of American foreign policy they have worked on resolving together and deserve a lot of credit for between 45 and 49. My grandfather comes on board. Everything is amicable. My grandfather's the deputy. Kennan runs the policy planning staff. And then the moment which will divide them and which will set their lives on totally different trajectories and which will set up the rest of the book comes in August of 49. That's when the Soviet Union sets off an atomic bomb. So up until this moment, the United States has had atomic bombs and nobody else has had any. And that's a really nice position to be in because you can blow everybody else up, but nobody can blow you up. So if there's a conflict, you can say, well, we'd like what we want because we can blow you up. Once the Soviets have an atomic bomb, it completely changes the strategic balance. And so the question for Truman is, should the United States go to the next level? Should we build a hydrogen bomb? And Truman says, okay, what are we going to do? And he says to Acheson, tell me what to do. Truman has a committee of three. He knows Acheson will be the tie-breaking vote. Acheson says, well, let me get my two top thinkers. He says, Nitze, Kennan, what should we do? My grandfather, Nitze, has a very simple syllogism, which is, well, are the Soviets going to try to build a hydrogen bomb? Yes. If they succeed in building a hydrogen bomb and we don't have a hydrogen bomb, will that be bad? Yes. Therefore, we should build a hydrogen bomb. You know, very simple ABC. He goes and he works the bureaucracy. He pulls people in. He talks to them. He works with clearances. My grandfather's already become very good at bureaucracy. You know, if you can just set the clearance level at this level, then this guy I know is against me won't be able to get into that meeting. You know, or let's try to, like, exclude these papers from that person and push this person aside. And if I go and talk with this guy, we can really make it work this way. My grandfather starts to master this technique. He's very good at it. He does his whole life. So he spends the fall working the State Department and trying to work with the State Department, work with the Defense Department, trying to make it all work. Kennan says, oh, this is the most important question we've ever faced. And he goes into his library and he thinks and he writes and he reads and he goes back and he emerges a few months later with a 79-page paper. Quotes the Gospels, quotes St. Paul, quotes Shakespeare. Kennan is amazing writer. You ask what Cold War historian is the best, most talented writer? It's George Kennan. I mean, he's incredible. It's beautiful, and it lays out in many ways what will happen, which is, well, what should happen? If we build a hydrogen bomb, the Soviets will follow. And then we will build more, and they will build more. And eventually we'll have these incomprehensible arsenals. And we'll have these huge arsenals of nuclear weapons, and we won't be able to think about rationally about foreign policy. We'll just become obsessed with numbers and metrics. And he's right. You know, he foresees in many ways what will happen. But of course, he's also, you know, he's a genius, but he's also a fool, because he's got a 79-page paper, which he starts to pass around in December, a decision that has to be made right then. The decision is actually made at a meeting with Truman and Acheson that is logged at 7 minutes. This is not, the way government works is people do not sit around and read 79-page papers with long expositions on Shakespeare and St. Paul. So as brilliant as Shakespeare, as Kennan was, you know, it was more of a New York Review of Books essay than it was an actual government policy paper. And so, of course, he ends up having very little influence on the debate. There are lots of factors at play. It's not as though, you know, the whole arms race is set by this little debate between Nitzsche and Kennan, but it is a microcosm of a larger, I mean, it's a very important part of a very important decision that is made in February of 1950, which is, we're going to go ahead, we're going to try to build a hydrogen bomb, and the arms race is off. My grandfather will then write his famous NSC 68, we need to quadruple the military budget, we need many more weapons. Kennan, you know, gets depressed, leaves government, and that's kind of, you know, from that moment on, their trajectories are set. Kennan will from then on be a brilliant outsider. He will always write. He'll write these beautiful essays. He'll always be correct. He will see things that people don't see. He will understand things that people don't understand. He will see deeper into issues. My grandfather will always work on the inside. He will work for every president up through Bush. He will be an insider bureaucratic player. He will, you know, rise up. His highest ranking position is Deputy Secretary of Defense, who will be our lead arms negotiator. He will always continue the same pattern of, you know, working the bureaucracy to get more weapons throughout his entire career. Not to say that my grandfather is, he's also fired, however. I would like to make an aside. My grandfather, despite this record of longevity, or perhaps causing this record of longevity, is fired or demoted by Roosevelt, Eisenhower, Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon, kind of Ford, not really, Carter, and Bush. So it's not as though I just made it sound, I wanted to add that aside, because I didn't want to make it sound like his trajectory was too straight. It's not a straight road from the beginning of Paul Nitzsche's career to the end. He would constantly alienate people, constantly get fired, and then constantly pick himself back up. So Kennan becomes an outsider, and I'm going to read a little passage that will get across how his political thought and some of his personality, which will help set up a discussion later about how to apply his ideas to foreign policy today. So Kennan, this is from 1951. This is the nadir of the Korean War is December of 1950. He had actually come back into the State Department briefly early in the Korean War, the summer of 1950, and he and my grandfather had actually agreed for a brief moment, and they had agreed. When they agreed, they were almost always right. If you could get the two men, to agree on something, it probably was the right policy. And what they agreed on that summer was that we were giving too much freedom to MacArthur, and he probably shouldn't keep going north. But he does go north. Things go badly. The Chinese come. They push us back. Everybody gets very unhappy. And so this is Kennan has some diary entries, which I won't read, but they, you know. I became aware of the remnants of anxieties and desires thrashing about like leaves when the last swimming pool is left. If dislike for oneself were really, as the religious teachers claim, the beginnings of virtue in the sight of the Lord, then I should be on the verge of saintliness. I had access to Kennan's diaries for the first historian who was given access to these, and they're amazing. I mean, his public writing is pretty remarkable, both in its depth and its self-flagellation. His diaries are shocking. Okay. Kennan did not explain where specifically the angst came from or what caused it, but misery often sharpened his mind. He wrote the long telegram while violently ill. He, quote, felt his mind function better when his body was horizontal, said his longtime secretary, Dorothy Hessman. His 79-page essay about the hydrogen bomb came as he lost faith in his country to do the right thing and in himself to have influence. He wrote his brilliant letter to Acheson during the nadir of the Korean War when despondent. In the decades to come, almost all of his finest work would derive in some way from what he called the turmoil in the pool of the soul. At this time, it was no different. The six Chicago lectures that he delivered in April of 1951 were classics. He collected them in a book titled American Diplomacy, which would stay in print for 35 years and become a standard university text. From now on, he would have no need to doubt his ability to maintain a reputation or a bank account. The slim, crisp volume is generally described as a broadside against, in Kennan's own uncharacteristically clunky phrase, a legalistic, moralistic approach to international problems. The first word referred to his belief that international law, or organizations like the UN, could not resolve the world's woes. The second word pointed to America's tendency to sit in moral judgment over other nations. The book was a critique of American democracy and its influence on foreign policy. In the first five lectures, Kennan traced American decision-making through major international events, run from the Spanish-American War to World War II. In each case, Kennan asserted, American politicians had acted unwisely. They did not understand what other nations wanted. They did not understand their own nation's actual points of leverage. In large part because of poor leadership, the public remained indifferent until war began, whereupon hysteria followed. The latter problem particularly infuriated Kennan. A conflict between the United States and another power could suddenly seem like an urgent necessity, even if it had not been deemed worth a single American life the day before. He declared, and this is that was just really a setup for this paragraph from Kennan's writing that I'll just read it to you and let you judge whether it's any good. I sometimes wonder whether in this respect a democracy is not uncomfortably similar to one of those prehistoric monsters with a body as long as this room and a brain the size of a pin. He lies there in his comfortable primeval mud and pays little attention to his environment. He is slow to wrath. In fact, you practically have to whack his tail off to make him aware that his interests are being disturbed. But once he grasps this, he lays about him with such blind determination that he not only destroys his adversary, but largely wrecks his native habitat. So that's Kennan, I think, talking about American democracy in 1951. You know, the man who creates the Cold War, the great light of American foreign policy, the man who conceives of the Marshall Plan, really didn't think that highly of the way our foreign policy worked. Now I want to skip ahead 5 years, 1956. So by this point, my grandfather's been fired by Eisenhower. He had been extremely close to Truman, worked with Truman, had become head of the policy planning staff when Kennan left. He had wanted to stay on. He had, you know, tried very hard to adjust his views and work with Eisenhower, but he, you know, wasn't going to work. My grandfather wore a bow tie. He was from Harvard. He lived in Georgetown. He had a reputation, despite his... One of the things that plagued my grandfather throughout his career, he's a hardliner who looks like a softie, right? I mean, who goes to the schools and talks about the things that, if you didn't read his classified papers, you don't have access to them, you think he's a dove, and this will constantly come up against him. And so McCarthy requests his files. I found this in I got my grandfather's FBI files from the Freedom of Information Act, and there's a memo from Senator McCarthy would like to see Paul Nitz's files. And there's a little bit of heat building up on him, so he's forced out in June of 53. So he's forced out, as he does throughout his career. As soon as he's forced out, he spends the rest of his time trying to undermine whoever had fired him. He actually does this even when he's 82. He's 82 years old. He's fired from the first George Bush administration. The first thing he does is give a series of off-the-record interviews trashing James Baker, who he believed was responsible for his sacking. So I don't know. It seems like a good lesson for life. If somebody fires you, the first thing you do is kick him in the shins. All right, so that's my grandfather. He's out. At this point, he's been writing, or I guess he's setting up to write some documents about the failures of Eisenhower's foreign policy, which will mysteriously leak to one of his friends at the Washington Post. I'm going to read this passage because it's very relevant to what's happening this month. This is 1956. Khrushchev has come to power. Stalin has died. Khrushchev has come to power. He's just given his famous secret speech where he says, okay, everybody, yeah, a lot of bad things have happened in this country, which is sort of a revelation. The Soviet leaders generally don't talk about the people who've been killed and disappeared, but they're all Stalin's fault. You know, they certainly weren't mine, but it's not the fault of the system, it's the fault of this man. So Khrushchev gives a speech and starts to inspire conversations about the meaning of communism. And as happened recently, where protests in Tunisia spread to Egypt, possibly to Sudan, protests start. It takes a little bit longer in 1956 than it does in 2011, but it happens this year. Protests appeared in Poland in June, sparked by food shortages, but also fueled by the new debate. In late October, students in Hungary began demanding economic reform, free speech, and limits to repression. Mass protests and riots broke out. On October 23, protesters tore down a statue of Stalin in central Budapest, leaving just a pair of empty boots, posthumous humiliation for a man sensitive about the size of his feet. Kennan thought this could be the beginning of the fissure he had long believed would split the Soviet order. The empire was coming apart, just as he had predicted in the X article. Interviewed by Joe Alsop for the Saturday Evening Post, he sounded uncharacteristically enthusiastic. When Alsop asked why his prophecy of an eventual breakaway from the Soviets by Eastern Europe was being so dramatically fulfilled, Kennan answered that the Soviet Union always had a problem in the region. Its countries had enjoyed greater freedom and wealth than the Russians. Allowing that disparity to continue would cause severe difficulties at home, but reversing it would cause problems in the satellites. Second, Kennan said, quote, "It is the plain fact that the Soviet communist system is deeply wrong. Wrong about human nature, wrong about how the world works, wrong about the importance of moral forces, wrong in its whole outlook. For this reason, I've always doubted whether the Soviet system would ultimately survive in full totalitarian form, even in Russia itself." It was possible, Kennan argued, that the Red Army would squelch the protests, but that would only slow, not stop, the fundamental changes ongoing. Kennan predicted that Khrushchev would eventually lose power and the whole system would open. I think that the recent developments in Poland and Hungary are bound, sooner or later, and I don't predict the timing, to mark the end of Moscow's abnormal power and the domination throughout Eastern Europe. The Soviet leaders, he said, never realized how terribly tight the spring had been compressed and what impetus it would get if you loosened it a bit. In answers to Alsop questions about American claims that the United States deserved credit for what happened, Kennan told an old Russian fable about a fly who spends the day riding on the nose of an ox. At the end of a hard day at the plow, the ox returns home, and the fly proudly greets the village. "We've been plowing." America provided a useful example of how free people can live, but it had done nothing to actually help. Kennan, usually so prescient, made two errors that were rare. He was too optimistic, and he misjudged the Kremlin. Even before the interview appeared in print, headlined, quote, "The Soviet will never recover," tanks had rolled into Budapest. The Hungarians fought back as well as they could, hoping desperately the United States would come to their aid. Teletype messages sent within Hungary to the Associated Press in Vienna vividly recounted the destruction of the dream. These are teletype messages, which today read kind of like Twitter posts. "Russian gangsters have betrayed us. They are opening fire on all of Budapest. The whole people ask for help. Young people are making Molotov cocktails and hand grenades to fight the tanks. We are quiet, not afraid. The fighting is very close now, and we haven't enough Tommy guns in the building. We need more. It can't be allowed that people attack tanks with their bare hands. Goodbye, friends. God save our souls. The Russians are too near." The fighting ended quickly. Thousands were killed, a new government was installed, and hundreds of thousands fled. The ox was gored, and the fly could do nothing but buzz manically and then drift away. Kennan, consulting with John Morey, head of Soviet operations for the CIA, had no solution. A sudden war in Egypt's Suez Canal surprised and distracted Eisenhower, with the British and French backing an Israeli attack on Egypt, which had nationalized the canal during the summer. No American troops would go to Budapest. Kennan, then 52 years old, was 85 when Eastern Europe opened again. In November 56 for him was a month of triple defeat. Adlai Stevenson lost the election, the Hungarian freedom fighters lost the war, and Eisenhower undermined the British and the French by threatening to deny support for the pound sterling if the battle continued. To Kennan, the latter was an unconscionable betrayal of our oldest allies. He wrote in his diary, "The events of these recent days have been so shattering that I'm at a loss to know how to react to them personally. If war comes, as it probably will, I had best seek a military commission and serve wherever then am asked to serve. I shall probably not survive it. One rarely really survives two world wars in responsible public service. Nor will it make much difference what I do, for a government so unable to use serious counsel in time of peace will scarcely be able to make better use of it in time of war. But by holding a commission, I shall give my family a better break in a country which has no use for civilians in wartime and which prefers that people serve uselessly in uniform rather than that they serve usefully in civilian clothes." That's Kennan at a moment of despair. One parallel that I'm sure many of you have noticed is that the head of special operations for the CIA in 56 during this is Frank Wisner, who was one of the early founders. And he was desperate for the Americans to come to the aid of the Hungarian freedom fighters. He goes to Vienna, which is the closest he can get to the action, and he watches sort of the refugees coming in bloodied and defeated. And it leads sort of to a nervous breakdown. He's manic depressive, but it leads eventually to his sort of entire psychological breakdown and his suicide 9 years later. And as we all now know, Frank Wisner, his son, is the special envoy who Barack Obama sent to go see Mubarak just last week, which is, there's no useful lesson you can draw from that, but it is an interesting fact. All right, so that's 1956. Kennan will continue on this path. He will continue to write these wonderful essays, these wonderful books. He will foresee what will happen in Vietnam with sort of more clarity and rigor than almost anybody else. He gives congressional testimony in 66, which anticipates where the war is going, explains what the problems are, explains that, yes, we are fighting communists in Russia. We are concerned about communists in China. These people do call themselves communists, but actually this is not part of a grand global conspiracy. In fact, the Vietnamese hate the Chinese. One of Kennan's views, which I think is applicable to the war on terror, is the sense that just because someone is put inside of certain ideology doesn't necessarily mean that you need to fight them that way, right? Just because somebody says they're a communist doesn't mean you should treat them the way you treat all other communists. He actually, when Harry Truman pronounced the famous Truman Doctrine, which said that Americans support Democrats all over the world and we are opposed to communists all over the world, Kennan said, this is ridiculous. This is a terrible idea. As soon as you do this, we'll have dictators coming to us saying, hey, there's some communists in the bushes. Please give us guns. Which of course is true. And he thought it was a much too reductive way to look at foreign policy. My grandfather thought it was a brilliant speech. Thought, it's true. We do want to get rid of communism. Communism is a terrible thing. Democracy is a good thing. So that was an early difference between them. All right, so the 1960s come. Kennan continues to write these essays. My grandfather comes in. He works in the Kennedy administration. He's sort of pushed aside. Comes back up. He finally gets to be sort of at the top of the Johnson administration. Thinks he's going to get a senior job in the Nixon administration. Doesn't work out quite the way he wants to, as always. There's a great memo. I know some of you have served in the diplomatic service. One of the my favorite memos comes in 69. Mel Laird, who's the defense secretary, wants to make my grandfather ambassador to Germany. You know, he thinks it's a, you know, someone who's a political opponent of the administration, but still a useful guy to have in power. It's a good spot for him. And so he sends a memo to William Fulbright, who's the head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and says, Nitz would make a good ambassador to Germany. And there's a memo that got sent back to Laird, and it says, Fulbright and my grandfather had clashed on Vietnam. And it says, it is the view of the senator that Nitze would not make a particularly good ambassador to Germany. He might, however, make a good ambassador to Mali. So I'm going to read a short passage here about the 1970s. The 1970s are the decade when everyone in Washington learned the fateful acronyms. Our silos were stocked with ICBMs, intercontinental ballistic missiles. They were armed with MIRVs, multiple independently targetable reentry vehicles. If the Soviets attacked, our best bet would be to counter with SLBMs, submarine-launched ballistic missiles, or maybe one day stop them with anti-ballistic missile, ABM systems. Nitze had helped coin the new vocabulary, and now he would master it. He studied the weapons the way a monk studies scripture. Every word and every weapon had meaning. World peace hinged on a stable relationship between the U.S. and Soviet arsenals, and that stability could hinge on apparently tiny details. If Moscow were allowed to build just a few more of these, with those components, and we did not counter with this, the Soviets might be tempted to start a war. He began his reflections on the balance of atomic weaponry in Hiroshima with the Strategic Bombing Survey. He had continued them since. Both at the beginning and at the end of the decade, he knew more about nuclear weapons than almost any other man alive. Nitze's fascinated immersion was matched by Kennan's willfully uncomprehending alienation. To him, the acronyms and the details were preposterous. What could 1 or 20 or 100 more of these horrors possibly mean if we already had enough to turn the planet into Venus? In one sense, the stockpiles were all too real. In another sense, they were imaginary. For tinkering with numbers and fretting over ratios, we created an illusion of control. The truth was we had built something far too powerful for us to manage. The two men reached these opposed conclusions through temperament and experience. Nitze had spent his youth building home telephone sets. Kennan had quietly written poetry. Nitze came to trust and believe in the power of numbers, whether in the form of Clarence Dillon's financial charts or Albert Speer's list of ball bearing factories. Kennan believed that technology is destroyed more than it created. Nitze spent his life gaining confidence. He was unusually popular, generally the smartest man in the room, and always well off. From the death of his mother soon after birth, Kennan spent his life learning doubt, self-doubt, as well as doubt in the wisdom of the men making decisions for the world. Nitze's career had led him to believe that the U.S. government, especially when he was involved, could make sound decisions. Kennan felt that the U.S. government was all too likely to go astray. Nitze believed he could answer the new epic questions. Kennan believed that nobody could do so, and that the ghastly weapons were now in the saddle and riding mankind. The two men had agreed on a great deal in the previous 20 years, Korea, Eisenhower, Vietnam. But by the end of 1970s, when nuclear weapons haunted every element of American foreign policy, Nitze and Kennan seemed to agree on nothing. Now they truly became the hawk and the dove. Next, I want to talk about a slight diversion from the heavy, weighty foreign policy stuff we've been talking about. One of the tricks in trying to write this book, I was talking to Pat about this in the car ride, was to try to make it interesting. And, you know, there are a lot of acronyms you have to deal with when you're writing a book about Paul Nitze, and there's a lot of sort of deep thinking about Bismarck that you have to deal with when you're writing about Kennan, and you have to address all that. I really wanted to tell a story, and I really wanted the book to be interesting. And so when I began, I thought I had two major problems I had to deal with narratively in this book. The first is, how do you get the reader to trust you when you're the grandfather of one of the two characters, the grandson of one of the two characters? Were people going to pick up this book and think I'm just shilling for Nitsa, or that I've, you know, got some complex and want to take him down a peg? And how do you get them to trust you? And the only answer I came up with and what I tried was to try to write it as objectively as I could. Don't think about him as Gramps. From the minute you start writing this book until the minute it's out, don't call him Gramps, think of him as Nitsa, and just do your best to do that. And so you can judge the results whether that worked or not. The second really hard problem is, how do you make it interesting at certain points in the book when they're not, you know, when they're not running around to Hiroshima or out in Red Square, and particularly the 1970s, and particularly Kennan? You know, what was I going to do with Kennan in the 1970s? And I'd gotten access to his diaries, but the diaries I had access to ended in 69. He'd left public service. So he's really just at home in Princeton. And he's writing these books, but they're sort of thematically similar to the books he's written before. And, you know, he's brilliant. But my grandfather is also, you know, brilliant man, and he's running around to these arms conferences, and he's fighting, and there are death threats with Henry Kissinger, and there are, you know, all these crazy things going on. He's getting fired, and there's all this intrigue. And I was so worried when I started this book that the 1970s would be unbalanced and that there'd be nothing interesting to write about George Kennan. But then it turned out, a new character appeared who I had actually knew almost nothing about, which is Stalin's daughter, Svetlana, who some of you may remember. She comes to the United States in 1967, and she's frustrated with her country. She wants to leave. She's married to a man from Delhi, and when he dies, she wants to go and dump his ashes in the Ganges. And when she's there, she says, you know what? She's a very impulsive woman. She says, I'm going to leave. And so she walks up to the American embassy, knocks on the door, and says, hi, I'm Stalin's daughter. I'd like to defect. And, the Stalin? Yes, this Stalin. And then the guy says, hold on, let me go check with the CIA station chief. CIA station chief says, Stalin had a daughter? They call Kennan, great Russian expert. Kennan flies over. He meets her in Switzerland. It turns out, indeed, she is Stalin's daughter and looks just like him. And they strike this incredible friendship. She moves to Princeton. She lives at his farm when she arrives. But befitting Stalin's daughter, she's not exactly the easiest woman to get along with. And so they have this incredible, tempestuous friendship. And she's I actually got to know her quite well. I went out and visited her. She still lives in America. I've spent a lot of time with her. I still get a letter from her every 2 weeks. We became quite good friends. She's extremely insightful. She's brilliant. Every now and then, she writes me these long letters with insights into Kennan. Every now and then, she writes me letters saying that I'm the most horrible human being she's ever met and never wants to speak to me again. And how could a young man from a good family end up being like this? And then, you know, 2 weeks later, you know, my daughter is doing this, and here's a picture of her cat. But I'm going to read a letter that, one thing that she does, so Svetlana, to set this up, she gets a letter from the widow of Frank Lloyd Wright, Olga Vanna Lloyd Wright, who believes that this Svetlana is the reincarnation of Frank Lloyd Wright's daughter, Svetlana, who had died, and that in order to better communicate with the dead soul of Frank Lloyd Wright, she needs this new Svetlana to come and marry the old Svetlana's husband, Wesley Peters. So she sends a letter to the new Svetlana at Kennan's farm. Svetlana gets it, says, okay, fine, comes, actually falls in love with Wesley Peters, which Olga Vanna believes will improve communication with the dead, but then gets pregnant, which Olga Vanna believes will reduce communications with the dead. So Olga Vanna calls George Kennan and says, please tell Svetlana to have an abortion. So my initial fear that there'd be no human drama, no excitement with George Kennan's life in the 70s, turned out not to be true. All right, so I'm going to read a letter from Svetlana to Kennan that, let it speak for itself. Dear George, I think I should tell you something that has been so many times on my lips in these recent years. There's something I always wanted to express to you, somehow, sometime, in some possible way. I must put it in a very short, simple message. Dear George, you are unhappy. And this is obvious, because you constantly betray yourself. You do not allow yourself to be yourself. You've put yourself and your life into that pattern of, pardon me, please, that deadly Presbyterian righteousness, which looks good only in pronouncements from the pulpit, but is based on a human experience of a different era, different people, different social milieu than yours. You are a naturally by birth great American idealist. People like artists, utopians, politicians belong to this just as well. People like Lincoln, Whitman, Frank Lloyd Wright, yes, Thoreau, and others were born to be misunderstood, to suffer through their lives of great discoveries, fighting with miserable middle-class mediocre mentality of their compatriots and of the rest of the world, people whose genius would be recognized too late. You're a writer, not that academic historian who, no doubt about it, has collected awards every year from all the important institutions of the world. Did these awards make you happier? You could have written a great number of books of your own philosophy. It would be the most perfect American philosophy. It was your own fault that you never allowed yourself to be what you are, to be what you've been born for. George, I wish you not to be so frustrated, hopeless, and sad about yourself. You could just allow yourself the way of life you wanted in Scotland or elsewhere, where you could totally separate yourself from the killing vanity of your home in Princeton, from that depressing Norwegian narrow practicality of your family, from constant calls from Washington which frustrate you and remind you that you are a retired ambassador. You do not need another award. You have them all. One thing that would make you happy would be a book where you could freely express yourself, your philosophy of history, your view of your fellow Americans, your love of them all. So I have this trove of letters from Svetlana to Kennan. Kennan's responses, they're, you know, Kennan's responses are, of course, measured, cool, insightful, you know, and dear Lana, it saddens me that you would blah, blah, blah. And so that added a whole lot of exciting intrigue. And then also there's an effort that Svetlana's, Stalin's grandson to defect all this intrigue with the CIA. So it turned out to be much more interesting from a human perspective to write about Kennan, which also made it easier to write about his ideas. All right, I'm going to read one last passage, and this is the very end of the book. So the 1980s, my grandfather becomes the Reagan's chief arms negotiator. Turns out, I guess we should say a word of praise for Reagan. It is now 100 years and a day since his birth. My grandfather liked two presidents. He liked Truman, he liked Reagan. Possibly because there's similarities between them, possibly because they both treated him well, possibly because when Truman was president, my grandfather was too young to be Secretary of State and hence was not frustrated when he didn't get it. And when Reagan was president, he was too old to be Secretary of State and hence was not frustrated when he did not get it. But in either case, he adored Reagan and thought Reagan was, clashed with Reagan. But he was very close with George Shultz, Secretary of State, and he thought Reagan had the right instincts, that Reagan genuinely did want to end the Cold War. So my grandfather is a great negotiator, knows all of the details. I went to Moscow to go interview many of his counterparts, and my favorite thing that one of them said to me was, well, your grandfather, he knew so much. He was a god, just not our god. My grandfather freelances. He has his famous walk in the woods during the INF negotiations where he decides the Americans are being irrational, the press is confusing things, all these aides are getting in the way. He says to his Soviet counterpart, okay, let's go take a walk. Let's just go out here and we'll figure it out. The two of them sit down on a log in the rain and they settle it. They figure out how to solve this impossible impasse and they bring it back to their respective leaders and are told, no way. During Reykjavik, the moment where it actually seems as though the Cold War might come to an end, my grandfather is passionately arguing for the elimination of massive reductions of American nuclear arsenal. He stays up all night. My grandfather's 79 years old. He stays up all night. 7 in the morning, he goes, wakes up George Shultz. Shultz in his pajamas. He tells him what we've accomplished. And Shultz says, my God, my God. We're very close to getting it. The question then hinges on a tiny detail about missile defense over whether, on the restrictions that we provide on American testing of missile defense, whether to be in a laboratory or not. And Reagan comes back, should we make the deal? And my grandfather, yes, make the deal. And other people like Richard Pearl saying, don't make the deal. And Reagan eventually decides not to make the deal. And Gorbachev decides he can't accept America's terms and collapses. And my favorite photograph in the book is a press conference right afterwards where my grandfather, he's old, he's worked hard. This is supposed to be the climax. This is supposed to be where he succeeded and used all his knowledge to get us the deal he wanted to end this arms race. And you can see Reagan and you can see Edelman and all of them sort of standing. And my grandfather, this old man who's pulled an all-nighter to fail. But as it turns out, it turns out to be somewhat irrelevant because the Soviet Union will soon collapse. Soviet Union collapses. My grandfather and Ken and everybody forgets that they disagreed for 50 years. They're both hailed. My grandfather's asked, why did we win the Cold War? Well, George Kennan came up with the right framework. I made it operational. Kennan basically says, we would have won it a lot sooner if it hadn't been for people like Nitze. But they're both, they're both great icons of American foreign policy. So I'm going to read the very end of the book and then talk briefly about two ideas of Kennan's that could apply to our world today. In late September 2001, I visited my grandfather in his home in Georgetown. As he often did, he sat in his study, leaning back deeply in an oversized easy chair. A cane rested by his side. Books were stacked on a table next to a small silver bowl of nuts and a glass of red wine. He moved slowly and had grown a light, scratchy beard. He talked infrequently and with great effort. I would often come just to sit near him and keep him company. Sometimes I would read to him. This day, he started by saying how shaken he had been by the terrorist attacks on the Pentagon and the World Trade Center. I nodded, told him I agreed. After waiting for a bit, I decided to ask a question. I noticed the complete works of Conrad, each conspicuously worn on his bookshelf. How, Gramps, did you have time to read all these books when you were negotiating all those arms treaties? "Missiles are boring," he replied deliberately. "Conrad is interesting." He then began to reflect a bit over his life. Again, he paused. "Sometimes I think I've had so much more luck than I deserve." That evening, I wrote down another nugget of wisdom he passed on that day. "I keep going because I still find it interesting." 3 years later, in the summer of 2004, we had our last conversation. I came by to tell him of my engagement and plans for a wedding that I knew he was far too frail to attend. "Is she kind?" he asked. "Yes," I replied. He came back with the last sentence he ever said to me. "Tell me about her." On October 19, 2004, he let go his grip on life. Kennan gave one final public interview in 2002, when he was 98, warning that the United States should not rush into Iraq. War has a momentum of its own, and it carries you away from all thoughtful intentions when you get into it. Today, if we went into Iraq, like the president would like us to do, you know where you begin. You never know where you're going to end. His body was frail, and he knew it was time to tie up his most important loose end. One day, he put on his coat and tie and told his nurse, Betsy Barrett, that he wanted to pray for his mother, who, he said, had died knowing that she would never know her son. He went to his church and spent 15 minutes on his knees. He never mentioned her again. Ken was determined to be alert for his 100th birthday. As the day neared, he tried to stay sharp by folding little pieces of paper and trying to keep track of them. But he knew he was losing control of his mind, just as his wife of more than 70 years had. Annalise was of sound body, but she could no longer remember what she had done during the day. One of the last things Barrett remembers is Kennan tenderly looking at Annalise, who he knew could no longer understand him. He wished, he said, that we could go down the steps and out through the door together. He died at age 101 on March 17, 2005, just 149 days after the death of his lifelong rival and friend. The ideas I want to talk about briefly, and which I think we can get more into in the question and answer, are expressed somewhat in that last passage of Kennan's about Iraq and about his views, philosophy throughout his entire life. And there, you know, there are two concepts or schools of thought that can be applied to our world today. There's actually, you know, there's not a lot. I'm sometimes asked, what would my grandfather do about the war on terror? What would my grandfather do about this? What would my grandfather do about that? You can't actually apply my grandfather's political philosophy to the world today. My grandfather's political philosophy is very much a Cold War philosophy, and it's very much about nuclear balance, and it's very much about, you know, the balance of power when you're dealing with these weapons with one other superpower. And his views on strategic balance and weapons and missile defense are, you know, very important in that context, but it's hard to... I remember, you know, after my book came out, sometimes when I was reporting, I would ask people, you know, what would Nitzsche think about the world today? What would his view be on what we should do? And invariably, everybody would say, well, Nitzsche would believe this, and then would lay out whatever their view of the world is. And if you're talking to a liberal, Nitzsche would be a liberal, and he would believe this. Or a conservative, Nitzsche would be a conservative. I remember once this incredible feeling of relief. I was on a panel with Richard Perle, one of the architects of the Iraq War, and a great friend and sometimes combatant of my grandfather's. And the question came, what would Nitzsche do about the Iraq War? And I was positive Perle was going to say, oh, he would have been in favor of it. And then Perle would have laid out his justification. And Perle said, you know what? You just can't apply Paul Nitzsche to the war. You know, Paul Nitzsche was, you know, very much Cold War philosophy. And you can extrapolate it, but it will be phony. Kennan, however, there are two ideas that I've talked about that I think are important. The first is realism. And that is the sense that when America engages with the rest of the world, it generally messes it up. Now, you can agree with it or disagree with it, but if you were to take Kennan's view, you know, America doesn't understand the cultures. There aren't enough people who speak the languages. We have this Congress, which is elected by people who don't know a whole lot about foreign policy. It elects people who don't know about foreign policy. They have all of this influence. They tend to, you know, move passionately like the serpent who sits in the primeval mud and doesn't actually do anything until you whack its tail off and then lays about itself with such wrath that it destroys the environment around you. So if you apply the concept of realism, for example, to the war in Afghanistan, it's not that he's not an isolationist. You know, Kennan certainly believed in fighting in Korea. He certainly didn't say immediate withdrawal from Vietnam. You know, there are certain things that require combat. He thought that, you know, there was a moment where he considered the possibility of invading Iran in 1979 because they had taken American diplomats hostage, and he believed in all the diplomats in the room will be happy to hear, believed very much in diplomatic decorum, and if they've taken our diplomats hostage, then perhaps we should go and attack. But his general sense was that America just doesn't understand the world well enough to have a positive influence. It almost certainly will have a baleful influence. And so what you need to do is to set your objectives as narrowly as possible and limit what you think you can accomplish, because then you will mess up fewer things. So in Afghanistan, I think he would have been in favor of, when the great debate was happening last fall, probably with what became known as the Biden approach, which is that you should, you know, focus on al-Qaeda terrorists. You should continue to try to break up, disrupt those networks. If you can do it without violence, if you can do it through disrupting money transfers, fantastic. You should certainly try to limit any incentive or impetus they have for further recruitment. If you try to actually rebuild the Afghan state, if you try to work with Karzai, even before we learned all that we know about Karzai right now, you'll end up in trouble. So I think Kennan would have taken a very, very removed approach to policy in Afghanistan. He would have been very much against the labeling of something as the war on terror for the reasons I talked about with the Truman Doctrine, the sense that there's a great difference between terrorists. There are Al-Qaeda terrorists who want to kill you. There are Hezbollah terrorists who probably have more nationalistic concerns than internationalistic concerns. And then if you group everybody together, you will then sort of encourage a worldwide enemy to rise against you as opposed to splitting it apart and try to figure out how to play them off against each other. The second related element is containment, and that's the view he laid out in the X article and the Long Telegram. And the idea of containment is that you don't have to kill your enemies. You know, if you believe in the United States and you believe in the system that the United States has, what you need to do is to keep this country strong and hope that soon your enemies will collapse upon their own, based upon their own internal flaws. So if the idea is to contain radical Islam, what you need to do is to not give it any incentives to further recruit people and bring people in. He would have, as seen by that quote at the end, absolutely opposed the invasion of Iraq, not both because of the uncertainty with war, which is what he specifically says, but also because of the fear that if you go to war in Iraq, you will then create a reason for the rest of the world to hate the United States. And what you don't want to do is to give your enemies who already have that more reason to hate you, more reason to use you as an external enemy, because that provides strength for them. So he would very much have opposed that. He would have wanted a much more limited war on terror. Trying to apply those two ideas to Egypt is a little harder. I think he probably would have done something. I don't think Obama's foreign policy is relatively non-aggressive in most ways. And certainly in Egypt, Kennan would have supported, don't go in there. Certainly don't alienate the Muslim Brotherhood, which we may have actually done this based on what I was just told this morning about recent reports about some things Frank Wisner said in Germany. The United States, if you go in there, you're going to make a hash of it. And you're going to make things worse. So let's just let it go. Let's let this regime change happen if it happens and follow that. The one caveat I will put here is that that's Kennan's philosophy after 1949, which is that the United States government can do no good. His philosophy when he's in government turns out to be different. He's one of the people who sets up the covert operations wing of the CIA. When he's running it, he has great confidence in America's ability to change the world. He's the one who actually recommends that we hire Frank Wisner. He would later say it was a huge mistake. I never should have set this up in the CIA. But I think the difference is, both like my grandfather, just a profound sense that when you're in government, you can make the right decisions. And when you're outside of government, the government basically makes a mess, which is actually something that he and my grandfather both agreed on. So I'll leave it at that, and I'm sure we have lots of questions. I'm happy to talk about questions from their life or anything.
Can you, in your researches and in your own opinion, imagine anyone with the influence and insight in American foreign policy that those two fellows had for so long a period of time? Is there anyone who's filling their role today?
That's a great question and a hard one. The two people who popped to mind for slightly different reasons, the first is Richard Holbrooke, who is no longer with us, he's one of the differences. Holbrooke has always been a Democrat, whereas both Nitze and Kennan were sort of post-party. They both were parties of one. The political system, I don't think, required people to be as aligned with one party then as it does now. You could still advance. Obviously, part of the reason my grandfather never made it to Secretary of State is that he was never fully on anybody's team. Holbrooke made a decision to be fully on the Democrats' team, but both for sort of the persistence, the vigor, the rigor, the determination, the longevity, the focus, Holbrooke would actually be something of a parallel. And then Secretary of Defense Gates, who has switched, but has been worked with Republicans, worked with Democrats, has a reputation for being a great technocrat. Both Kennan and Nitze, for all you disagree with them, were never accused of corruption. They're always accused of being wrong, but they're never accused of being wrong for the wrong reasons, right? They're accused of being, and this is partly how they were able to keep her friendship. They didn't think that they were doing it because they wanted more to sell more books or to get more hits on Meet the Press or to, to get a good consulting contract with Lockheed or more money for their law firm or whatever. They were wrong because they just got it wrong. And so there was a real integrity to them, which, you know, I don't know Gates' career that well, but I have never heard people accuse him of, you know, being partisan or, you know, selling out for money or these other less noble things.
Could you, it's asking a lot, but could you give something of what you think your grandfather might have thought of Henry Kissinger?
I can tell. How many hours do we have? Let's just say the relationship got off to a bad start. My grandfather and Kissinger were on a panel together at the Council on Foreign Relations. I won't go into the details, but my grandfather believed that Kissinger took his ideas and turned them into a book, and that book happened to sell a lot of copies and made Kissinger a very important political figure. My grandfather then reviewed the book with a review that included a sentence something along the lines of, "Every line in this book contains either an error or a lie." That did not ingratiate him with Kissinger. Later, my grandfather believed that Kissinger had sold out the SALT negotiating team, which my grandfather was leading, for the sake of political benefit, both so Kissinger could be on the cover of Time magazine and so Nixon would have a better shot at the 72 elections. And my grandfather then worked to undermine Kissinger and helped, after my grandfather was fired in 74, Kissinger was going to give some testimony in front of the Senate about SALT negotiations. My grandfather, being an insider in the SALT team, helpfully gave some questions that Kissinger could not answer to Senator Scoop Jackson and embarrassed Kissinger on the Senate floor. Later, they would reconcile. You know, by the time they're 85 years old, what's the point in fighting anymore? They got along much better. Kissinger, you know, accepted my request for an interview, was extremely helpful. I have been told that he very much enjoyed the book. Probably not three pages in the middle. But the, you know, the, at the end, you know, and Kennan and Kissinger is also a fascinating relationship because Kennan believed that Kissinger understood containment better than anybody else who held high office during the Cold War, and he believed that Kissinger's view of how people, how countries should be played off against each other, decision to open up China, the decision to do this, China decision to do that, was a very sophisticated view about how containment could be used to split the enemies, and Kissinger believed that Kennan was brilliant. My favorite story that Kissinger told me when I interviewed him was that Kennan came calling on him in 69 and said, you know, Kissinger, I've noticed the way you've been manipulating the exchange rates and visas in Taiwan, and I know that this means that you are soon to make a secret approach to open up relationships with China. And Kissinger had exactly been doing that, and no one had figured it out. No one knew that. No one had seen through. But Kennan could read minor intentions in diplomatic cables and channels better than anybody, you know, else in government, and Kissinger was just flabbergasted, stunned, and amazed. So he had great respect for Kennan's viewpoint. There also, I have some phone transcripts I couldn't resist putting in where the two of them talk about human rights, and you might have been able to guess from some of the quotes from Kennan, and they weren't talking positively about Sakharov and Solzhenitsyn. There was a real cynicism about the way human rights are being used in foreign policy.
Can you, again, you know these people pretty well from mm-hmm. your research. Can you give us any thoughts on what you think they might have thought about what's going on in Egypt and what our country's response to that situation should be?
Well, you know, with my grandfather, I'll punt because I don't know. You know, I can understand, I can talk about weapons and I can talk about I talk about two-player game theory. It gets more complicated when you add more. I think Kennan... I think Kennan would actually be quite pleased that so much is going through the State Department. He always believed that there's tension between state and defense, and he certainly would be pleased that State Department envoy is the one handling this. I think he would be generally pleased that the State Department has taken a relatively low-key approach to pushing events in the Middle East, at least as far as is publicly known right now. I think he probably would also have a very sophisticated critique about how we've blown it as well. He would, you know people now in the Egyptian government. He would have a sense, and he would have known about Mubarak's corruption, and he would have been a critic of. He probably would have deeply criticized Mubarak up until the moment where he probably would have said, "Don't push him out as quickly," right? So he would have been more in favor of acting heavily against Mubarak a year ago, and less in favor of acting now.
I think you've helped work up an appetite for most of us, and it is lunchtime. Thank you very much for your...
Thank you very much for having me here.
One more.
Thank you, Tom. Sure.